Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you. This is a presentation that could probably go in a number of different categories at this meeting. We ended up here, which is an honor and a pleasure. What I'm going to try to do is connect our research in diversity in crops and crop diversity in diet to priorities for research in crop science, agronomic science, soil science, which is quite a task, especially in 10 to 12 minutes. I'll do my best, and I'll stick to the time. It sounds like they're having a good time on the other side, so I'll also try to speak up if I can. The roots of this research come from, full disclosure for me, I'm a plant genetic resources person, a conservationist, really, of diversity in agriculture. And my interest was in understanding in the global food system how diverse really is our system in what we produce and what we eat. And so we start with a very simple question, or at least you could say it is, which is simply how many crops really feed the world? And it's an interesting one if you think about articles that are written about agriculture, about climate change, about feeding the future. It's kind of always this sentence in these articles that says something like X number of crops feed the world. Maybe it's 3 crops, maybe it's 12 crops, maybe it's 30 crops. But it's in there somewhere. And I've never been quite sure whether that question means that we're really intelligent or that we're really vulnerable. It's kind of left open for people to decide about that. So I started looking into it. If you look on websites, there's a random assortment of websites, nobody chosen for a particular purpose. But people come up with quotes like 80% of our calories in this case come from 12 crops, maybe 50% from 3. Okay, well, that kind of makes sense. But you look at a different one. This is an institution I used to work for, and we were saying, well, three crops provide 2/3 of our calories. Okay, well, that's not exactly the same, but it's kind of close. A lot of this data comes from FAO originally, and FAO is saying here, well, 30 crops provide 95% of our energy, maybe 4 of them provide 60%. Now, this is really global aggregated data, and yet we still can't decide exactly how many crops are feeding the world here, which is kind of interesting. I like this website of a university in the UK that just decided to say a small handful of crops feed the world. That kind of works easier for everybody. Along came this paper in the 90s, 30 years ago, the data comes from 30 years ago, and it was trying to do a better job of understanding how many crops feed the world, looking instead of gathering all this global data kind of in a very aggregated way, it looked on national level and said, okay, what are people eating and how important are they? And it sort of gathered a list together. It ends up, of course, with a bigger list, maybe 100 crop species kind of feed the world. But that's where we started with this research. Like, really, how many crops feed the world? These folks, the way they did that, they took basically, as you probably all know, basically the data we have for looking at global statistics and agriculture FAO data, for the number of ways that you can look at that data in these systems, which is essentially calories, protein, fat, and food weight. That's really what we can measure across the world right now. From 30 years ago or so, and it came up with that number of about 100 crops. So we were interested in how many now. Has it changed a little bit over time? And really, that's a much more interesting question, because it really doesn't matter how many crops exactly feed the world. You can cut it a million different ways. Really, the question is, are we becoming more diverse, less diverse? Are we losing crop species entirely? That was really the question. And so to do this, we had to take a data set from across our whole time series, which is about 50 years, from 1961 to 2009. And we found that we didn't lose any crops entirely out of our global food system, but we ended up with quite a lot of change over time, and that's what I'd actually like to speak about in the next probably 8 minutes. To put this in context, the first thing we need to know is that we're of course eating more food in general. So this is not looking yet at what crops we eat, but sort of these categories of food categories. A is calories in our diets, B is protein, C is fat, and D is food weight. And that's our time series from left to right, from 1961 to 2009. And essentially what you need to look at right there is simply that we're getting bigger, right? We're eating more. This is a mean across countries of their diets, yeah? The big one I want you to look at, though, is C, which I'm going to talk about more in a minute. You see that big change in sort of yellowish, but I'm not sure what color that is. The big change there, that's oil crops. And that's a watershed change in human history right there that we'll talk about in a moment. So we're eating more food. The second thing that we found in the diet, in this dietary data, is that we're actually eating a more diverse diet on the national level. Now that's a little confusing, maybe for some. It's very intuitive for others. Of course, if you look around and you think, okay, well, we're eating pizza now in Japan, and we're eating potatoes in Vietnam and all these things, and it sort of starts to make sense. What this is showing is that we're eating a more diverse diet of the big global commodity crops, not the really local stuff. We'll talk about that in a minute, but that stuff is sort of declining or disappearing. But around the world, people are eating a more diverse diet of big global commodities. This graph, to explain it, has all four metrics in it. As we go up over time, that's our mean. Those dots are countries. That's our data set, and this is the number of crops that each country is eating. This now is our data on exact what foods they're eating. This is maize versus rice versus sorghum versus potatoes versus onions. So we're eating a richer diet, a more diverse diet over time of these major crops. Within our diets, we're evening out in the dominance of whatever particular food that is. On the left, that's an evenness metric we use in ecology. It's essentially just whatever you're eating in your diet, how dominant are they? And they're sort of evening out in the diet over time. And the right, that's simply looking at how dominant is whatever the most dominant crop is in the diet. So Vietnam, if I can use that case again, in the 1960s, 70-80% of calories came from rice. That's declined over time as wheat and potatoes and other crops like that have become more important in the diet. So an evening, a richening. And then further, across the world, we're getting more and more similar over time to each other. This is a metric that simply looks at what are people eating, how much are they eating of those crops, and how similar are those to the rest of the world's diets. I'll depict that a slightly different way after I show this map, which is these are the countries that have changed the most. Blue is positive change towards more homogeneity or more uniformity in around the world. Sub-Saharan Africa and East Asia have changed the most towards this globalized, standardized diet over time. Probably the best way that we found to show this is 50 years ago, these dots represent how different our diets are around the world. The dots are countries. How far away they are from sort of the center point is how different their diets are. That circle represents an uncertainty metric, a variation metric. 25 years later, this is how close we are to each other, and in the present time, we've reached just about that point in how diverse or how different our diets are. Is this good or bad? First, I'll talk about in just two slides, after I show this sort of, this is the important slide, really, so I'll leave it there for a second. What is that diet composed of? These mean figures of what a diet looks like around the world are, of course, dangerous to show because there's a lot of variation, of course, in what people eat and a variation in countries. But for what it's worth, the important thing to know is here's our 61 diet. Of course, there was a less amount of food and calories. It's grown bigger by 2009. Those big crops like wheat and maize, rice, sugar have only become more important. And then some crops have come along that really weren't that important 50 years ago, particularly soybean, palm oil, a couple other oils. The other important thing to point out is even though these mean things across the world are never completely true, it's more true now than it ever was before because we're really becoming more similar in our diets around the world, at least for these global commodities, if you allow me that. Or please challenge me after. If you look at relative change instead of absolute importance, these are the crops on the positive side, on the blue side, that have really changed the most towards becoming more important in our diets around the time. So again, the oil crops have become. Wheat, maize, and rice, of course, are still positive. They couldn't have become all that more important because they're already so darn important. And then you see that it's really the regionally and locally important crops that have started to decline or marginalize in our diet. So the big crops are still big, they're getting bigger. The oil crops are coming up over 50 years in a global trend. Our regional crops are marginalizing, and what we know from local studies, not FAO data, but local studies, is that those really locally important crops are also declining or disappearing. That's the state of our global food supply in terms of crop diversity. So I think I have about 2 or 3 more minutes to talk about why this might be important or what we might do about it as agricultural scientists. I'm going to skip over the drivers, which take maybe an hour to kind of thoroughly discuss. They're big, of course: economic progress, globalization, urbanization. We're at, of course, an important point in history when we just crossed over with more people now living in cities than live in rural areas. My argument here is also that agricultural development has been a big part to play in this. And this change has been both positive and negative. Don't let me start out by saying that it's a negative change. But certainly our development, particular crops, a huge amount of money, a huge lot of investment, have influenced how important they are in diets around the world. The impact on health and on production systems, real quick, definitely a positive impact in terms of feeding people, purely calories feeding people. We have less stunting around the world. We have less underweight people around the world. This is children from 1990, as a global trend in 50 years. Micronutrients, it's kind of a mixed bag. We've done positively in some degree. We have a lot more to do, particularly vitamin A and some of the other issues. And then we have the other side of the nutrition transition, which is excess calories. And this is an issue no longer just in the United States, but in Mexico, in China, in Nigeria, in Bangladesh. We have more people overweight now than underweight. This figure is only rising. It's going to rise, and we have in the United States an epidemic that's coming around the world. So positives and negatives of this change. Of course, this change is not just due to changes in diet. It's changes in lifestyle and a number of other issues. Changes in production systems, ever more larger, more homogeneous systems to support these systems. And more interdependent systems. This is the Tokyo Metro system. I have a whole analogy that we don't really have time, but the essential element is highly productive, highly efficient. If it breaks down, it affects a lot of people. Like over lunchtime when the Tokyo Metro broke down and affected 1.5 million people's transport. You have systems like this, of course. If the Ukraine has civil upset, then maize and wheat systems are disrupted around the world. If the Philippines, the largest producer of coconut around the world, has natural disasters that affect us. And these issues of soybean and palm oil, environmental issues, are global issues. I'm just going to put this up to say one point. A lot to do in the future. We all see this. It doesn't impact us that much anymore thinking about it. There's so many information about climate change, about all these issues. My one point is, it seems to me that no matter what the solution is, a lot of it comes down, to science, it comes down to research, and it comes down to researchers becoming advocates or activists for change in a way that we want. A laundry list of issues that we might be able to approach this to make positive change. These systems absolutely now, feeding so many people around the world on these major crops, means that these crops need to be productive in the long term, year after year. That means genetic diversity, conservation, use, employment of that genetic diversity. It means increasingly looking at nutritional diversity within those foods. Biofortification, of course, supplementation on the side. There's an entrance, I wanted to just put this up, there's an entrance on the market side, there's an increasing interest in alternative, let's say more diverse varieties within major crops. This is an interesting wheat variety that's become popular in Arizona, much more drought tolerant, less productive, but there's a space for it as people get more interested in alternatives. So here's the genetic diversity slide, since I'm a genetic diversity person. We need genetic diversity, we need gene banks, we need international treaties that facilitate access to that genetic diversity around the world. And my question is what we do about these crops that are marginalizing around the world. Is there a place for them? Do we want to invest in them? I would say yes, and it's neat that some things like quinoa are getting a lot more press. My last slide to show you, I come from the International Research Center, so the CGIAR. this is what we invest in as a whole international research group in total. On the x-axis is how important these crops are, again, as a global mean to calories. On the y-axis is how much money we put into them. So we put most of our money into those big crops, which makes sense. They're the most important crops around the world. The question is, these crops on the bottom there, what do we do about them? And would it be possible if we raised up the money there, would they head over and become more important? Would that be a good thing? I'd like to leave it more as, less than a statement myself, but just as a question to you all, which are, of course, much more experts in your own field than myself. Thanks.
One question. What is the role of private companies, between the seed companies, in this diversity of products? Because ultimately, when we are in an era of industrialized agriculture, unless we partake in this kind of activity, people will not properly see the end of the what is the perspective on that?
Yeah, so the question is, what's been the role or what is the role of the private industry in pushing these changes? What does that mean? This is a great question, and one of the aspects of this particular slide is that the CGIAR, the International Agriculture Research Community, contributes 3% of global agricultural research funding to the world. 3% of public funding. So most of funding around the world is actually national public funding, and then there's private funding, which is at least 20% of overall funding around the world. Hugely important is the answer to the question. Whether the privates are looking out for human health or soil health is another one that I'll let you kind of decide for yourself.
Okay, thank you very much.